There are thousands of books for kids written about things kids love, like animals, insects, and dinosaurs. Some of those books are cute and engaging, but they get the facts wrong. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Nonfiction kids' books with factual errors got under the skin of Christine Duell, and she decided to do something about it. She and illustrator Katie Castronovo created the Budding Biologist series. I'll talk with them, and we'll talk about fact-checking nonfiction books for kids with Tom O'Donnell of the Krell Institute in Ames and Barb Stein of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Animals, insects, dinosaurs, and many other parts of the natural world are popular subjects for kids' books, both fiction and nonfiction. Sometimes, even when books are supposed to be factual, they get the facts wrong. This drives my first two guests today crazy. Christine Duell is on the line with us. She is an ethnobotanist at the University of Florida and a mother as well. Hello, Christine.
Hello.
Hi. And Kay Castronovo is here with us in Iowa City. She's an artist and an illustrator. Hello, Katie.
Hello. Nice to be here.
And Christine, I'll start with you. When you started reading kids' books, you started noticing that there were some factual errors. Tell us what your experience was.
So my son was born in 2010, and as an ecologist and a biologist, I had amassed a collection of nonfiction books about the natural world, and I was really excited to start reading to him. And as I did so, I started to realize that there were all of these errors in the books. For instance, I would read books about insects. Since I study plants and insects, I know a lot about insects. My husband's an entomologist, and we even decorated my son's room in insects. So we had a lot of insect books, and almost every one of them included animals that were not insects in the books, such as spiders, were very common throughout the books. And I got really frustrated and told my husband, I'm like, you know, I don't understand why this keeps happening, because obviously a spider is not an insect. And he said, well, that's obvious to us, but it's apparently not obvious to the rest of the world. And then later on, a couple days later, I had my son in a bouncy chair that had a theme about baby animals of the rainforest, and I'm drinking my coffee, looking at him and going, I think there's a giraffe's head sticking out of the rainforest, and well, there's a zebra over there. Well, that doesn't make any sense, because those are savanna animals, and this is a picture of a rainforest. And I just thought, you know, somebody did not pay enough attention in biology class. And I thought, you know, these are the same misconceptions that I deal with teaching students biology. Most of the students come into the biology classes not being able to recognize categories of animals or habitats of animals or what a plant is even. And so I said, you know, these misconceptions are obviously starting from this young age, and we need to change that.
So when you were looking around you, I mean, I understand looking at a book that's supposed to be about insects and seeing a spider and finding that frustrating. When you're looking at a bouncy chair that probably when it was designed, nobody ever said this needs to be scientifically accurate. Is there a distinction here that you need to make between things that are supposed to be factual and things that aren't necessarily?
So I should point out that the theme, the rainforest babies theme, it's, you know, it's everywhere. It has all kinds of stuff, including books. And so we had that set of books. And so they were also in these nonfiction books that we were reading. But it's, you know, it should be scientifically accurate to the point of you could just call, you know, the bouncy chair a baby animal's chair, and then it would be fine. But if you're going to be very specific about that, there are lots of really great animals in the rainforest to use, and incorporating those from other areas, you know, there's, you know, toddlers running around looking at these pictures and saying, hey, look, there's a tiger in the trees of the jungle. And it's like, okay, well, that obviously is a misconception then. So while we're not advocating that every single thing in the world needs to be scientifically accurate, there in nonfiction literature and just in nonfiction in our lives, we should strive for decreasing the misconceptions that are out there in order to help our kids understand what is accurate and what is not accurate.
I want to bring Katie Castronovo into the conversation. And the two of you are working together on a new series of scientifically accurate books called Budding Biologist Books. And we'll talk a whole lot more about those books in just a moment. But Katie, how did you and Christine meet and start talking about this?
Well, we actually were pregnant at the same time. We both lived in Florida and we met at a birthing center. We had our children 2 weeks apart. So that's how we met initially. And we would meet together with our babies for play groups. And Chris told me about her idea and I really resonated with it. And she was looking for an illustrator. So we started working on it then.
And Chris, I have the impression that, that this really grabbed hold of you and was driving you crazy, all of these inaccuracies.
It was, and it's because I teach university students, and I saw those same misconceptions at that point, and I'd been trying to figure out for years how the students would get as far as a university and still not be able to understand the characteristics that make up an insect or make an animal, or you know, the students will come in all the time and categorize mushrooms as plants. And I thought, you know, here are 18 and 19-year-old educated students who have these misconceptions. And so when I started seeing those in the literature and started learning more about education of young children, I realized that they're grabbing those ideas and holding on to them. And once those ideas have implanted in their heads, very difficult to have them confront them and realize that they're inaccurate. So I started becoming really frustrated that these errors are holding on until adulthood.
Now, at this point where this was bothering you, I could see you going in a number of different directions. You know, you could have started a blog and started picking all of the books that you thought were scientifically accurate and trying to spread the word.
Sure.
But what gave you the idea of actually creating your own books?
Well, I wanted something to read to my son that was accurate, but was really entertaining and fun. So I started looking specifically for accurate science books, and they are out there. However, what I was finding was that, you know, while they're out there and some of them are really good, a lot of them have poor illustrations or they aren't as exciting and entertaining as these other books are. And I thought, you know, this is something I can change. And I tend to have that mentality as a scientist of like, oh, wait, we don't know this or this is incorrect. Well, I can change that. And so I went into this going, you know, I can fix this. And I didn't quite realize what I was biting off because it became a much larger project than I initially expected. But I, you know, I just need something to be able to read to my son that is fun and entertaining and bright and colorful, but also scientifically accurate. And so I decided, oh, I can start writing children's books.
And did you try to approach publishers with this idea?
So we did, not really knowing what we were getting into. And after a very brief time of looking at different publishers and what they would offer, we realized that we really wanted to retain the rights to the books and to the characters and the creative rights, because what we didn't want to happen is that we get it edited so much that it gets simplified to the point of becoming more inaccurate. And so we decided that at least these first couple books, we wanted to do them ourselves so that we could make sure that the quality was there that we were looking for.
So, Katie, when you started illustrating these books, and the first book is out, and it's called Am I an Insect? And it's a fairly simple book. I can imagine reading this to a 2-year-old. I can imagine reading this to a 5-year-old. I can imagine a 5-year-old reading it to me. And you needed to illustrate the book with scientifically accurate pictures of things like a horned beetle and a ladybug. And often when you see pictures of particularly ladybugs. They're all, you know, always cutesy and they have smiles on their faces. What were you going for with these illustrations?
Well, I had noticed that, too, and there's such a wide range of illustrations, especially with ladybugs and things like that. So I knew definitely I wanted to make them look like a real ladybug. So I do lots of research, just looking online at different images, and Google image search is great for that. But I wanted it to be vibrant, not, you know, I didn't want it to just be a photograph. I wanted it to be art, and I wanted to bridge art and science with this project. So deciding how I was going to do the illustrations, I did a lot of experimentation, and that was just like simple painting, and I colored pencil, and I decided on like a combination of digital and painting. So I scan swatches of paint that I've just on different textures of paper. I scan them into the computer, and I use that, and I use lots of different layers, and so that kind of it creates a vibrancy, I think, that that makes it more interesting for young eyes,
right.
Instead of it just being a photograph.
So now, of course, the two of you are working on this together, and you both have young children. And what I've noticed is that when you have young children of your own, you tend to have other young children in your lives as well. Did you test out your book
in
these pictures?
Yes. In fact, talking about holding on to misconceptions, after the first book when we were in the editing phase, I had a playgroup over, and I read the book to a group of kids, and then we went outside and we were looking for insects. We wanted to identify different animals in my backyard, and we were lifting up bark from logs. And all the parents were like looking at these like millipedes and roly polies, and we realized like these aren't insects. Like we thought they were not. Maybe we didn't think they were insects, but that's kind of the category that in general
they were creepy crawlies, right. And we tend to lump all those together.
Right.
So you've learned a few things through this process as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. I mean, being not a scientist, that's what's so great about collaboration. In this way is that, you know, I'm learning a lot about science as well.
All right, we're going to take a short break. I'm talking with Christine Duell and Katie Castronovo. They are the author and illustrator behind the new series called Budding Biologists. Their first book is called Am I an Insect? And we'll talk more in just a moment. You're also welcome to join our conversation. Are there books that you've come across where you've found scientific inaccuracies that have bothered you? Maybe you don't think it's that big a deal. Let us know. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about facts in children's books. And my first guests today are the people behind a new series of books called the Budding Biologist series. They've released their first book. It's called Am I an Insect? Christine Duell is a PhD biologist at the University of Florida. Katie Castronovo is an artist and illustrator in Iowa City. They've been working together on these books. And we've been talking about how when the two of you started reading books, particularly you, Christine, before your son was born and when your son was born, the fact that there were a lot of factual errors drove you to create your own scientifically accurate books. And Christine, I have to ask you about a book that I think every child reads, and that right. is The Very Hungry Caterpillar. And in The
yeah.
Very Hungry Caterpillar, of course, The Very Hungry Caterpillar eats a number of things. We learn about the days of the week. And then toward the end of the book, The Very Hungry Caterpillar builds a cocoon all around himself, and he stays inside for more than 2 weeks, and he comes out, and he's a beautiful butterfly. But butterflies don't actually come out of cocoons. They come out of a chrysalis.
That's correct.
Is that a factual error that bothers you, or is there a level of tolerance?
So I'll start by saying we don't actually own that book for that reason. But I enjoy the book, and I enjoy the art in the book. And Eric Carle, the author, he sort of has this interesting span between fiction and nonfiction. He goes back and forth between them. And I want to make sure that the audience understands that in nonfiction, accuracy, we're saying that accuracy is important, but in fiction, it's not that important. For instance, the beloved story of Wilbur and his eight-legged friend. In that story, the spider talks, and she's able to make a web, with words in it, and that's fiction. And that's
even though I have to say, looking at Charlotte's Web, all of the illustrations are not all of the illustrations, but the illustrations of the spider are scientifically accurate, and that I know that was something that was important to E.B. White. So there seems to be a lot of give and take there in the fictional world.
There is, and it's great that they did go as far as making sure that the illustrations are scientifically accurate. But at the same time, you don't want to squash the imagination that's involved in fiction. And books like The Hungry Caterpillar, I tend to categorize them more as fictional than as nonfiction, because the caterpillar eats all kinds of things a caterpillar would never eat. And in that way, I put that book in fiction, and then the imagination involved in that is great. But it's true that, even in these books that are sort of borderline fiction and nonfiction, they have these inaccuracies. And as a scientist, it does drive me nuts. As a parent, I try to bite my tongue on some of those, because these are now becoming American classics. And I do want my son to be able to know what the American classics are and have read them and be experienced with them in children's novels or in children's books. But it is hard as a scientist to see those inaccuracies.
Well, isn't that part of, I think, the problem is that you don't know what they're categorized as. Like, a book sometimes seems like it's supposed to be a factual nonfiction book, but has inaccuracies. So if Chris is categorizing The Hungry Caterpillar as a nonfiction book, but it is sort of presented at the end as if it's teaching you something about a caterpillar and a butterfly. So I think that is maybe where, an issue might be.
Right. Well, and as a parent, I read The Very Hungry Caterpillar, although we've talked about what that process is and the difference between moths and butterflies and that kind of thing in my house. And we've used that as kind of an opportunity to talk about that a little bit. There have been some books that I've thrown out. there was one about loose teeth, and it's just in my opinion, it wasn't a very good book anyway, but there was an elephant with a loose tusk, and I just couldn't take that. So I reached my breaking point on that. But, Christine, I'm interested. Of course, there is a lot of anthropomorphizing in children's books. So we see a lot of animals dressed as humans and walking around on their hind legs as if they're humans. And that's something that at least authors and illustrators believe is engaging to children, and I think it is. I think it's fun. How do you feel about that?
So I have two minds of this also. I think that it does engage the children, and again, it helps to promote this imagination, and it helps the kids be able to relate to the storyline. And if the reason that the animals are dressed up and they're anthropomorphized is in order to get the story across in a way that is engaging, I think that that's a good use of that. But if the point of it is to convey information about the animal itself, then you're sort of taking away the importance of how accurate that animal's depiction is by anthropomorphizing the animal. And I will say that that's another misconception that we see a lot in the university and in adults, is we have a tendency to anthropomorphize the entire world. And I think that's something that's innately human to us because we see the world through human emotions. And so it's hard for us to sort of step away from that. But it is something that we see a lot, again, that is held on to, these ideas are held on to into adulthood.
When you decided to write this first book, this Am I an Insect, why did you want to start there?
Mostly because that's a subject that I'm very familiar with. I work with insects every day, and I know what makes an insect. It's a fairly concrete idea, and so I started with the easier subject matter. And then the second book that we're writing is about animal adaptations to environments, and this is a lot harder of a book for me to write because it involves mammals, and as a biologist, I know quite a bit about mammals, but I don't work with them regularly in their habitats. And so I did have to do a bit more research and really thinking about the adaptations of animals, such as camouflage or body size. It tends to be that animals in colder climates are larger than animals in warmer climates. There's a trend towards that.
Well, and what age group are you reaching for? I mean, the first book, Am I an Insect, as I mentioned, I could imagine reading it to a two-year-old or somebody up to the age of five or even six. Are you trying to keep them all in the same age group?
A great question. So we're really looking at it as a level one and a level two. And so our first book was targeting a level one where it is basic enough information and simple enough information that it can span, a one-year-old through a six-year-old. This next book is a level two book, and so we're looking at that for a little bit older child. And even the way that we've set up the book, where the first book is a very simple, is this an insect? Is it a picture of an insect? You turn the page, and it says yes or no, and it gives a little explanation. It's a very straightforward concept for a young child to follow. And we've made the second book a little bit more complex, where there's two animals. We give a description of the environment and a picture of the environment, and they decide which animal would live in that environment. And so even the format of the book is a little bit more complex. We have a pipeline of about six books that are in various stages of being written, and the books fall into these two levels, level one and the level two. So we hope to get a lot more books out in the next couple years, both in the level one and the level two.
And you guys, as I mentioned earlier, you chose not to go the normal publisher route. You chose to self-publish. And you've put this up on Kickstarter.com, right, Katie?
Yes. And we just got funded, which is really exciting.
and for people who don't know, Kickstarter.com, you put your project up online and you invite people to invest, usually a fairly small amount. And if you set your goal, and if you get enough investors and you reach your goal, then you get that investment and you can go on with your project.
Correct. Yes. So, I mean, it's like Chris was saying earlier, we're learning a lot because, you know, I'm an illustrator, she's a scientist, and we're learning how to be business people and publishers. So
with Kickstarter, how have you gotten the word out to other people?
We used, social media mainly, and, you know, personal emails. I think with Kickstarter, that is mostly where you get your funders. And just asking people to spread the word was, I think, what made it successful.
And Christina, obviously you and Katie saw eye to eye on this subject. Have you recruited a number of other moms to your cause?
Yeah, as Katie pointed out, neither of us are business people, and so as we started this endeavor, we realized very quickly that there was a whole business side to starting these books and the series that we knew nothing about. And so we recruited another mom who is a business person who has an MBA, and so she runs all the finance and business side of the company. And then while I know a lot about education at the university level, and even I have worked in middle schools doing science stuff. So even at the secondary school level, I only know what I what I've read for personal interest about early childhood education. And so we've brought in another mom from that we had met through a playgroup who has a master's in language and development of early childhood education. So we needed some more help on the learning side of the consulting.
So have you completed your PhD, or you're just very close to completing your PhD?
I will be finished in April.
Okay.
There's light at the end of my tunnel.
Wow. So you've been completing your PhD. So I assume you've been teaching, researching, writing, and doing all of the things that go along with that. You are a mother of a two-year-old, and you have created this whole new endeavor. How have you managed to find the time to do this?
Well, this has been a lot of fun. And one of the things about being a researcher is that at this point in my career, I'm analyzing data all the time, and I can't do that nonstop for 8 hours a day. I would drive myself crazy. So this is a really nice break from some of that, and I try to give myself, this is my passion, and this is also my hobby, and so I try to give myself those breaks during the day to work on budding biologists, although I will say that it has taken over a lot more of my life than I had expected, which is great, and it's what I love doing, but it has made time for everything else more difficult, and it's been a balancing act for sure.
So you mentioned that there are six books in various stages of completion. Are you writing all of those books?
So for the biology series, I am. I'm writing all of the books, and I have chosen subjects as they sort of come up in books that I'm reading to my son. So we're thinking of, books about what is a plant or plant adaptations. We're also looking at books about what makes a mammal, that type of thing. We're also thinking about starting some other science series eventually, such as a physics series and a chemistry series. And for those, I will not be writing them since I am not the expert. But as I mentioned, we have somebody on our team now who is an expert in early childhood education, and her husband happens to be an astrophysicist. So the two of them together have started to hash out some manuscripts on physics for children.
And Katie, are you illustrating all of these books?
That remains to be seen, I think. It depends on a lot of things. I am mainly a full-time mom, so like Chris, I have little time. So lots of, during nap times and after my daughter goes to bed is when I'm working. So,
as these other subjects come up, do you find yourself doing research so that you can at least fact-check the books that you read to your daughter?
Definitely. Definitely. Well, it really has opened my eyes to all the books, and especially, being the illustrator, looking at what the illustrations are out there, like what kind of, there's some really crazy looking bugs out there, like insects.
Christine, do you have a collection of books? Have you found a number of books that you absolutely love that you feel are scientifically accurate and you can read to your son?
I have. And in fact, I'll point that there's a group at the University of Louisiana called 150 Degrees, I believe it is. And it's a group of researchers who every year look through the children's books that are nonfiction, scientific children's books, and they pick a winner each year. And they've been doing this for 10 or more years. And so they have a nice list on their website of books that they feel are scientifically accurate and entertaining. And so my son's Christmas list this year was a lot of those books.
Have you been surprised by how this has resonated with a lot of other parents?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm in the scientific community, so of course I think that this is really important, and the people that that I interact with every day think that this is really important. And what I've been really impressed with is how people outside the scientific community have really stepped up and said, no, we want our children to have the best education from a young age. And we expected that in some ways because of things like Baby Einstein, which have really taken off and shown that parents appreciate having tools in order to teach their children things from a young age. And so this is the science tool that allows them to do that.
And we have a caller we don't have time for, but she says the Magic School Bus books are interesting and educational, and that's a series of books where they really did focus on science. So there have been other books out there in the past decades. Have you dug into those yet, Christine?
I loved the Magic School Bus series when I was a kid.
All right.
I did, but the Magic School Bus tends to be more for the school-age children.
Right, for
and
older
so we
kids.
Were going for older kids, exactly. And as I found that for elementary school children, there are a lot more science-based books out there. But what we were focusing on is the younger kids, the kindergartners, the preschoolers, and even before preschool. And there isn't a lot out there right now for those
Christine,
children.
Thank you so much. Christine Duell and Katie Castronovo are the artist and illustrator and author behind the Budding Biologist series. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking today about accuracy in children's books, and we've been focusing primarily on nonfiction books for very young children. We were talking with Christine Duell and Katie Castronovo behind the Budding Biologist series. And if you're interested in finding out more about that series of books, you can find a link on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio. Now we're going to broaden the conversation a little bit, and we'd love to include you in the conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with me is Barb Stein of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. Welcome back to the show, Barb.
Well, thank you, Charity. I'm glad to be here.
And also Tom O'Donnell is on the line from the Krell Institute in Ames. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Glad to do it.
And Barb, let's talk about a bookstore's role in this fact-checking. Obviously, when a book gets published, it goes through an editing process. If it's nonfiction, you would assume that there's a fact-checking process that it goes through, although, as our last guest was pointing out, clearly that's not foolproof. How important is it to you to make sure that the books that make it to your shelves for kids are accurate?
Well, I think it's important. It's certainly, we have a very popular nonfiction section. And I think we want top quality whatever we're selling. It's not a huge, we can't have everything there. We want wide appeal to children. We want photographs, wonderful art, wonderful science. So, actually, because of my school library experience with elementary kids, so many times we do read stories in the schools. And then kids will say, well, I like the really books. I want to know about real things in life. And so you want to capture that curiosity and passion for the natural world. And so you want the books to be very appealing and very well written and very well illustrated. So it's important. It's really important. And I often steer customers in that direction when they're looking for a gift. It isn't always on someone's mind when they walk in the room, but if you say, sometimes kids really like these kind of books, they go, oh, yeah, and then they start looking and they get excited. So it's an important area of the store.
Do you get an opportunity to look at every book that you have on your shelves?
I can't say that I've looked at every single book in the children's
That's
department.
A lot of books.
I have, though. I'm not the buyer for the store and in the children's department. But every year, Victoria and I, twice a year, do book talks, and we try to pick the best of the best seasonally. So we may end up with 10 nonfiction titles, and so we're really examining them for those criteria of what's going to capture someone's attention and keep them engaged.
And Tom, let's bring you into the conversation. And you work for the Krell Institute in Ames. Give us a little bit of an idea of what the Krell Institute is about.
Well, we're a private nonprofit organization. We support the education, technology, and science communities through contracts. We work largely with the Department of Energy, supporting some graduate fellowships, and we do publications and websites related to that.
All right. And in being involved in technology-based education and science education, what is your interest in making sure that nonfiction books that reach this audience are factual?
Well, obviously, I think your earlier guest, Chris, said it right, that these misconceptions often take hold at an early age. And the earlier you can get the correct information to kids, the better. I think we're at Krell and throughout really the science infrastructure concerned with making sure that citizens are informed properly about science, the process of science, and the facts of science so that they can make the right decisions, and their policymakers at Congress and various agencies can make the right decisions based on accurate information.
In reviewing scientific books for accuracy, can you give me some examples of misinformation or inaccuracies that you've found?
Well, it's been interesting because I'm a member of the National Association of Science Writers, and there's been some buzz lately about some particular books or articles that have been out that have been kind of criticized for either inaccuracies or really carrying the conclusions of researchers too far. One example, I believe, was a recent magazine article in which a neurologist, I believe that might have been Time or Newsweek, I can't remember which, but the headline on the cover was "Heaven is Real," or words to that effect. This neurologist had a near-death experience and claimed that his experience was different from others because he's a neurologist and he claims to have kind of experienced heaven in his near-death experience. Other neurologists, scientists, and science writers have really criticized that article as being inaccurate, drawing some conclusions that may have gone too far, and things like that. And that's just kind of one example of in some cases where either pop science or drawing the wrong conclusions from experiences and research have been out there.
Well, I think there's probably a feeling among many people that scientific textbooks are not the most interesting things to read. Although, you know, we do see a lot of popular science. We see science making it into a lot of publications and as we've been talking about, into children's books as well. Do you think that there is a divide between the communities? Do you think that there are some people who think that it's more important to make science as completely correct, science writing as completely correct as possible, and less important to make it engaging? And then there's, on the other extreme, people who want to make it engaging, sometimes at the cost of factuality?
I don't think there has to be a divide at all. I think the best science writing is accurate and engaging, and that is the challenge of science writing. That's something I and science writers across the country and around the world face every day. How do we get this right? But how do we make it engaging for the reader? The best science writing does both, and it is not impossible to do both. At the same time, speaking of children's books specifically, the idea for a kid, especially at a young age of, you know, preschool, is that they get the concepts right. Yes, an insect has six legs, an arachnid has eight legs. The very precise details, if there's a word misspelled or a number wrong, may not matter that much as long as the concepts are right. As readers get older and are more critical, getting all the facts right really becomes more important.
You know, We have this comment from our Facebook page. Morgan says, as a writer, I'm more amazed at how bad some of the grammar is in kids' books. Mm. And she says, I've really enjoyed today's interviews, great moms and great contributors to nonfiction kids' books. But Barb, as someone who has been reading kids' books for a very long time, have you seen a change? Do you think that we're less careful?
You know, I think most of the things when you're really talking top quality, and this is changing in publishing because there are a lot more self-publishing. I think as Christine and Katie were talking about wanting to do it their own way, self-publishing is becoming really, really, really a big deal. But the problem is there isn't always an editorial department to help do fact-checking and so on. I think, as Tom says, getting the concepts right is really important, young. I think kids are eager for the right words for things. They like to have that kind of scientific information. I think the issue of our age across all disciplines is how do we know things are true? And I think one of the gifts you can give children is really reading a wide variety of sources, of having, I know lots of people like more computers, but I still love identification guides. There's a wonderful new birder's guide for young people and things like that, that you have accurate names, you have scientific names, you have ways to look things up right away. And I think with those resources, being outside in nature and observing and developing those skills so that what you're really bringing to any written page is the awesomeness of nature, the brilliance of it, the design of it, the right words of it. I mean, all those things together. So I think back to a bookstore is trying to find those books that would reinforce that idea of many sources. I mean, there are some wonderful science writers out for young people. Steve Jenkins is just wonderful in his illustration and the way he presents information in ways for young kids to really observe the animal kingdoms and so on.
Can you give me an example of something that he's written?
Well, my favorite one of his that I've sold lots and lots is Actual Size. And one thing that he presents there is that kids don't, because of the way illustrations go, they often don't really understand the real scale of an insect or an animal. And so everything in his book is the actual size that it really is, from an alligator head to the tiniest little critter, you know. And that has been wildly popular with kids between 4 and 7, say. And then he does one that's it's all about cats one way, all about dogs the other way when you turn it upside down. He does color, beautiful color, the way animals in nature can be all different vibrant colors and groups like that that you can look at together. Symbiosis, he looks at animals that, you know, live together and feed off one another somehow or contribute to each other somehow. So anyway, he's a wonderful author and illustrator. So,
and that's Steve Jenkins. I was just looking at some of his other books, Time to Eat, Time for a Bath.
Those are more baby. Those are younger children. And he takes one concept of how animals care for themselves as babies. That's a nice young series.
All right. And the as kids get older, I think you probably everybody who has spent any time with kids, they do know a 6-year-old who knows everything that there is to know about dinosaurs.
Yes.
Or something like that. As kids go through these developmental stages, I find it so fascinating that a child who maybe can't tie their shoe can tell you,
exactly,
names of dozens of different dinosaurs.
And those same kids know when there have been inaccuracies. They know, they say, no, that isn't right about that kind of dinosaur. And they really get to be, I think kids get really passionate. They get totally absorbed. They read lots and lots of things. And because of their knowledge, they do know when there are mistakes. And they can tell you all about it. And I think that's a wonderful thing. But again, there's that idea of looking at a lot of sources.
Well, and the kids, there seems, and I'm not a developmental expert by any stretch of the imagination, but there seems to be something at this, first grade, kindergarten, first grade, second grade, where they have this affinity for being an expert in something.
Yes,
this desire,
exactly,
to have complete knowledge,
yes,
of something.
And we want to capitalize on that. Back to the dinosaurs, I was going to say one of the misconceptions very common is that people lived at the same time that dinosaurs lived. And so, to see that in a book would be really disturbing to, you know, to getting...
Right.
Getting,
and you do see it all the time in children's books.
And time is very hard. It's really, really hard for young children. You have to be in junior high before you really start getting a real sense of time. So, you know, to go back millions of years is really hard when you're 4 years old.
Right. Yeah. So, Tom, do you have a pet peeve when you look around things that you see in popular science or books that are meant for a wider audience?
Oh, boy, you put me on the spot with that one. I think my pet peeve maybe is people misunderstanding the process of science. There are relatively few things that are settled in science. There are a few laws, but virtually everything is open to scrutiny and questioning and further research. And I guess one thing I dislike is seeing people saying, oh, this is absolutely settled. Or citing a study that was done early on and then failing to follow up to see that later on another study came out that either refuted those results or showed that the results weren't as strong as the first study showed. I think that's probably I think just people misunderstand that science marches on. Things often are called into question. You have to kind of stay on top of things to know what the latest things are. I mean, obviously, it's been well established that insects have 6 legs and arachnids have 8 legs, but many other things are still kind of open to question and
right. Well, I knew a whole lot about dinosaurs in 1981, and I don't know anything about them now. They've all the names have changed, and
and it's surprising to see how many new dinosaurs pop up. I think just the other day on one of the science websites I check regularly, there was a discovery of a skull of a rather fierce-looking underwater reptile that, would consume huge quantities of other dinosaurs, apparently.
How about you, Barb? Do you have a pet peeve when you see nonfiction books for kids? Is there something that drives you crazy? Or just won't make it on your shelves?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't make it on my shelves. I don't really have a pet peeve about that. I guess poorly illustrated, not giving good visuals, maybe too much text, assuming a six-year-old can read dense text. Most of them can't. So making sure the information is chunked in a way, that kind of thing. I guess my things would be more about design and appeal and making sure that they just grab that reader right away and want them to stay with it. That would be the thing I'd want.
Well, Barb Stein, thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Barb Stein of Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City. And Tom O'Donnell, thank you very much.
Glad to do it.
Tom O'Donnell of the Krell Institute in Ames. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime. We'd love to hear your response to things you've heard on Talk of Iowa. We'd love your suggestions about things you'd like to hear on Talk of Iowa. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk about the importance of actually taking your vacation time. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.